Hello, this is Kevin Barrett. If you like these radio shows, please go to truthjihad.com and subscribe. For only $3.95 a month, you'll get early access and free downloads. So go to truthjihad.com and make a one-time donation or subscribe for $3.95 a month. You'll be happy that you did. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the all-out struggle for truth, disguised as an internet radio show. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you alternative perspectives since 2006, when I was drummed out of the University of Wisconsin, and ever since then, Truth Jihad Radio has been a form of fighting back. Well, I enjoy bringing on folks who are still managing to eke out an existence inside the American Academy, such as it is, and telling a word of truth now and then as part of that. And there are more of them than you would think. I just ran into a guy who teaches very close to Ground Zero, New York City, and has 9/11 truth content in his classes every semester and has been doing this for many, many years. And actually, I've run into three or four people more or less along those lines. So it's always great to see people doing good work in the academy. And my guest today, Michael Rechtenwald, is one of those people. He teaches at New York University. He has published all kinds of interesting stuff, poetry. He's published books out on secularism. And he is known for being associated with Citizens for Legitimate Government, or CLG, one of the best alternative information outlets. His latest work involves, there's one on academic freedom. It's called Trigger Warning, Safe Spaces, and Bias Reporting, the New Microtechniques of Surveillance and Control. So I guess we'll start out around those topics. So, hey, welcome, Michael Rechtenwald. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be here. I'm well. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I really appreciate your work. CLG has been a great ally, of those of us trying to get a word of truth in edgewise.
Yes, it has. LegitGov.org is, I think, a go-to site for anyone who wants to get the news that is being squelched or otherwise ignored, even stamped out, and its promulgators persecuted.
And these perspectives are often taboo in the academy, whereas a certain kind of faux radicalism has now become de rigueur. The LGBTQ theory and practice, various forms of feminism, anti-racism, identity politics, all of that is almost a substitute religion, it seems, on many campuses these days, whereas the truth about 9/11, Zionism, just to start with those two, but there's a long list of other things, really, that we could add to that, are completely taboo. Yeah. You'll be drowned out of the academy if you even come near that stuff, but you're welcome to be a radical by supporting LGBTQ. And your article explores this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that the article does is to analyze what these mechanisms, what I call mechanisms of surveillance and control, that are associated with a diversity in its broadest sense. These mechanisms that are being mobilized by university administrators under the aegis of diversity itself. My particular contention here is that while these issues themselves are, of course, important, and while those politics should be carried out, the fact of the matter is that university administrators are co-opting these the discourses and the devices and the techniques of these movements, assimilating them into administrative policies, plans, and devices, for lack of a better word, in order to, what the effect is, I won't speculate on intention. The effect is what I'm calling, and what has been referred to by the scholar Michel Foucault, as panopticism. Panopticism is now making a new manifestation within the academy through this means.
Maybe we should mention, you know, what that means. Panopticism comes from, was it Jeremy Bentham? Or no, not Jeremy. It was Bentham, okay, who came up with that notion of a perfect sort of prison in which there would be a tower in the middle where the guard has a perfect line of sight into everybody's cell. So you're always under surveillance. And really the modern world is starting to look a lot like that, with little cameras in our devices listening to us. And, you know, the NSA could track our cell phones. If you carry a cell phone, essentially a bug that the NSA could use not only to locate you, but to listen to you if they wanted to. So we're kind of living in this panopticon now, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the notion of panopticism, which Foucault coined in his 1975 book, Discipline and Punish, The Birth of the Prison, is derived from Bentham's architectural device called the panopticon. The panopticon, conceived by Bentham, incidentally, as a reform of prison sites and education and hospitals and so forth, as you said, consists of this kind of model wherein there's a central tower and an annual rings around that tower where subjects, be they prisoners, students, hospital inmates, madmen, and women, and so forth, are available to the inspection at or observation at any time by a central by a guard in a central tower. Now they can't see into the tower, but the guard can see out. They can't see each other.
Wait a minute. Who's going to guard the guardians here? Plato would ask.
That's coming up. That's coming up. Actually, there's this gets very interesting. Actually. The point of the matter is that whether or not there's someone actually watching us at any time, the very potential of that observation, in effect, produces the intended effect of the prisoner, of the subject, of the student, of whatever, serving as their own form of surveillance. Or, as Michel Foucault put it so beautifully, he becomes the subject of his own subjection. So, knowing that we are potentially being observed at any given time, we internalize the observer and we become our own means of subjection. This incredible notion, which, by the way, Foucault suggests is the very modern form of power exercised after feudalism and in modernity in general. He generalizes this from the notion of the panopticon, but he says it both preexisted the panopticon and very much exceeds it as such. It is the model that is modern social control and power. And furthermore, he suggests, which is something that's quite interesting, that the very notions and the very panoply of rights that have been accorded us through the Enlightenment, you know, such as free speech and the right to vote, representation, freedom of movement, all these things, of course, right? He suggests, and this is controversial but interesting, okay, that they are all undergirded by, underwritten by, and utterly made possible only by this panopticism. So what the Enlightenment gave with one hand, it surreptitiously took away with the other.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, I remember reading that back in the day. I think the rise of postmodernism and post-structuralism and the sort of, I encountered it in the 80s and early 90s, as I recall.
But it
seems that, you know, that stuff, far from being dated, was actually on the money as far as what's been going on ever since.
He's very prescient. I mean, the guy is very prescient. And here's the irony about what I'm doing with this essay, okay? Many of this stuff, many of the politics that have been incorporated into the university by these administrators and have been, in effect, subsumed, co-opted, and altered to become disciplinary mechanisms, they are products of this postmodernism itself as well. In effect, they're connected, cognate to it. So what I'm doing here is I'm using one of their very own methods of analysis to critique the way the politics associated with this very movement have been taken up.
Interesting stuff. Well, you know, I would, you know, point out that this diversity movement that you discuss in your article with, you know, these, you know, huge bureaucracies of diversity, the under associate, you know, deputy secretary commissar for diversity enforcement kind of positions, you know, people pulling down salaries, taxpayer supported salaries for this kind of stuff. It's all kind of a bad joke in that the opportunity for real intellectual diversity and, in fact, diverse perspectives representing others with a capital O in our universities. Yes. It's pathetically absent. Just, you know, to give you an example, right before this interview, I just wrote a kind of an angry letter to the president of York University, Mamdou Choukri. Sounds like he's a diverse guy, a diverse subject himself, but his university fired a lab technician named Nikolaos Balaskas for posting things on Facebook that were essentially just a panoply of anti-Zionist posts, such as one of the things that got him fired was posting about how he was going to a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Another one was about the 9/11 being a Zionist attack on New York City that could not have happened without the full knowledge of high-level American traitors. As I say, that's as true as any 23-word statement about a complex historical reality ever could be. And on and on and on. Essentially, this guy's posting stuff on Facebook, which is, I would argue, you know, a lot of it is just plain true, and much of it is defensible. And the stuff that's wrong is just still within the realm of a reasonable way to be wrong. And yet the guy has been fired from the university for putting these things on Facebook. Now, the other point is that this material that he's put on Facebook, even though he's a Greek Christian, I would say all of it represents the mainstream Muslim majority viewpoint all over the world, where polls show that 80% of Muslims believe 9/11 was an inside job, and every other item that he posts would basically fall within the purview of what I have experienced to be what virtually every professor I ever spoke to in Morocco thinks, what every professor I've ever spoke to in Turkey or Iran thinks, what every Muslim I've ever spoken to here in the United States, at least every intellectual who actually looks into this stuff, thinks. So essentially, they fired this guy for, even though he's Greek Christian, but he's posting stuff that would represent the views of billions of people all over the world. In fact, a particular targeted group that's being targeted arguably for genocide. Millions of Muslims are being murdered because they're Muslims all over the world. And here's a guy who's not even Muslim, but he posts stuff that represents the Muslim viewpoint, and boom, he's fired. And you're not allowed to say any of this stuff. So what kind of diversity is this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just setting aside for the moment, if you will, the veracity or lack thereof, whatever, of his particular standpoint, okay? The problem is the question of, in fact, the very problem is the question of the right, not only of academic freedom of expression, but how about inquiry itself, right? What has happened to the possibility of asking particular questions at all?
Right.
This is being this particular say essential component of any kind of intellectual, even scientific inquiry, as being extremely curtailed as such. Of course, there was the case 2 summers ago of the university professor who had transferred to another university and was given tenure. His work was in Indigenous American Studies, okay? And I'm trying to find his name. Salida.
Oh, yeah, Stephen Salida, University of Illinois. Yeah.
Salida, yeah. He posted tweets. Actually, he's a Palestinian himself. He posted tweets after being hired by this university during the summer in advance of the semester when he was to join the faculty. criticizing Israel's bombing of Palestine at that time. Some of the tweets were quite emotional, and they had invective in them for sure. But he was, in fact, the job offer after he had quit his other job, after he had been given the offer as such, was rescinded. And as such, he was basically out of work. Having quit his other job, job offer rescinded, he's out of work.
Well, actually, there's a happy ending there, Michael. Continue then.
Yeah. He sued them, and I think he has won the case. Is that correct?
Yes. I think they settled with him, and he did get a fairly decent financial settlement, and he's now apparently happily employed at the American University of Beirut.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a happy ending, but still, the very possibility of, in fact, the actuality of what happened to him is indicative of the kind of chilling effect that surrounds inquiry in general, and in particular, as you've made clear, regarding certain particular third rails in the academy, such as the question of the relationship between Israel and Palestine, and of course the issue of 9/11. These are consolidated into third rails in academia, such that any approach to them, or certainly any embrace of them, will lead to your electrocution and dismissal.
Yeah, I did notice that from personal experience.
You noticed that firsthand.
Yeah. So an issue that comes up with all of these social media issues where, you know, Stephen Saleta was witch hunted, not because of anything he was doing in the classroom, but because of his polemical posts tweets. On Twitter. It's just tweets. Yeah. And this guy at University of York, Niccolo Belasquez, also is being harassed or fired. He's been fired for his Facebook posts. And there's a parallel with what happened to me there, because I never had any problem with anything I was doing in the classroom at the University of Wisconsin. I was doing a lot of 9/11 truth teach-ins and stuff on the side from 2004 mm-hmm. on.
See, yeah.
Nobody cared. I mean, it was actually every colleague I discussed it with basically said, you know, you could be right. I'm afraid to look into it because it you could be right. Okay. That's all I heard from anybody. And so in 2006, I was attacked by politicians for what I said on a radio show.
I see.
And that became the whole issue. The deceptive talking point that was used by Fox News and later even the New York Times, Stanley Fish in the New York Times, Noam Chomsky, was that I was supposedly imposing my own view of 9/11 in the classroom. And that was absolutely untrue. In fact, the students would never even have known what my view of 9/11 was in the classroom if there hadn't been this scandal or if they hadn't seen me doing a teach-in. So the point here is that in so many of these cases, what we're seeing is that the academy, which is supposed to be self-policing regarding what you do in the university, right? You should be teaching, you know, in a way that you can defend to your colleagues. And if not, then you won't get the job, or you won't get tenure, or you won't get, you won't get a raise. You won't become full professor, that sort of thing. That's a self-governing academy, and that's reasonable. People within the discipline have that knowledge basis to decide whether your methodology is sound within the university. But when you're being polemical, when you're being emotional, when you're exercising your right of free speech as a citizen of the United States of America, whether on Twitter or on a radio show or on Facebook, frankly, I don't see why it's any of the university's damn business what you say, as long as what you're doing in the classroom is okay with your colleagues. Am I crazy?
I've had cases where I've posted critical remarks, not having to do with these issues per se, but about other things going on in the academy, in particular my university. And I had a friend who said, quote, paraphrasing rather, "I wonder what what the higher ups would think about this," in a very threatening
I wonder what the panopticon would think.
Yeah, the panopticon was at work. That's just it. That was the panopticon at work. But I want to, some of these other devices besides this, well, some of the reasons why I talk about this in terms of panopticism have to do with some of these particularities about these devices. For example, trigger warnings. Now, students, there has supposedly been this student demand to have these warnings inserted into syllabi in order to suggest to students who may be triggered by particular kinds of reading or viewing or whatever, that, you know, they may have been sufferers of some sort of PTSD, and that these kind of events might trigger them to have breakdowns of some sort or another. The problem with trigger warnings is not whether professors decide to put them on syllabi. The problem is the potential of the administration to start requiring them, and as such, intervening in and controlling to a great extent the syllabi of those faculty.
Yeah, that's so crazy. Well, you know, when I was teaching, the thought that there would be such a thing as these trigger warnings in the academy, yeah. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s when I came into the academy, people would have laughed you right out of the room if you even suggested the possibility of something like this.
Now, I know you have or a scholar of Islam and so forth, but I think you'll still appreciate this particular example. I'm pretty sure it was Harvard and a class kind of like World Civ, okay, that kind of a class. Global literature, whatever. It included on the syllabus a piece by a rather obscure writer named Dante. And uh-huh. The piece was this rather marginal piece called The Inferno.
Yeah, I think now, I might have heard of that somewhere.
A student or more complained about this piece being on the syllabus, especially since it did not contain a trigger warning, especially with reference to the fact that it represented particular characters in hell and, as such, effectively is denigrating of them or critical of them, one of them being Muhammad.
You know, that's kind of interesting. I actually taught that in homeschooling to my son. We're Muslims, of course. And, yeah, I mean, I sort of did, you know, prepare him a little bit for that but explain the context.
Right.
But the idea that a bureaucracy would come up with some bureaucratic method for doing that, it's insane.
What happened was the pressure, I guess the pressure got to the department, and they didn't respond by adding a trigger warning. They evaded the issue by replacing the piece with a novel by Toni Morrison.
Oh, no.
I mean,
unbelievable.
You know, forget about periodicity or the, you know, historical implications. I mean, the fact that a whole era is basically being lost there, or at least some representation of it. I'm not comparing, you know, Toni Morrison to Dante, or, you know, and saying this one's more important than that one. I'm talking about the fact that it's the supplanting of this particular piece of work, which has its own merits and so forth, by a piece from the 20th century that has nothing to do with the issues being dealt with in the Inferno. It's a real... It's a sham.
Yeah, that's really sad. You know, and the chance for some really interesting, you know, dialogue of civilizations around the
exactly.
Inferno is lost because I don't know if you're aware of the Asin Palacios' work. It turns out that Dante, you could say he plagiarized, although if, you know, you'd have to say it was genius level plagiarism. But essentially, virtually everything in the Divine Comedy comes straight out of Muslim sources. There's this vast literature in Islam of the Miraj, the Prophet Muhammad's, peace upon him's, journey to Jerusalem and then up through the heavens. And there are all sorts of variants of this. And essentially what Dante did was he read a lot of these variants and synthesized this brilliant takeoff on it, but you know, mm-hmm. to my mind, it's ungenerous that he then put Muhammad in hell, because of course this was the whole thing was really about Muhammad's journey to heaven. But you should teach that. I mean, people should, you know,
he's adding insult to injury there, but still, that's an opportunity for teaching. That's a huge opportunity for teaching, and instead they evaded the whole crisis or conflict and just ran from it. Caved to the pressure and replaced the the book, the long poem, the epic poem with a novel from the 20th century. I mean, that's absurd. And they made sure, you know, and I have no problem with diversity per se as such, but the way it is used in the universities today is largely as a weapon. Diversity is another tool that can be wielded to punish particular people over different things that have maybe nothing to do with diversity issues at all. They can and do drum up issues, drum up diversity, supposed diversity slights or whatever, to wield those against dissidents of other types. It's quite incredible.
Wow.
I can't go into specifics right now because I might say that A, I'm up for promotion at this moment, and B, some of these issues on the table that I have dealt with personally and professionally may become legal matters.
Wow. Well, when and if you're at liberty to discuss that stuff, I hope you'll think of Truth Jihad Radio. You know, speaking of diversity, I actually, the basic notion of diversity, I think, could be used quite well and productively, but it would have to be sort of turned inside out from the way it's being used now, the way you're describing.
Right.
Various kinds of literary theorists and philosophers and great thinkers that I encountered when I was doing literary graduate studies, the one who impressed me the most was Mikhail Bakhtin, who views the entire, discursive universe as this vast dialogue and polyphony, but the way he sees it, that there's this integrity to all of these different competing voices which are bouncing off each other, and that there's, never, that you can't say the same thing twice, you can't step in the same stream twice.
Right.
But what that means then is that attempts to sort of use an abstract approach to bring everything together on the same page. That's actually what's destroying diversity. Promoting diversity is allowing a full dialogue in which different voices, radically different voices, disturbing voices, that get, mess with your comfort level, are allowed to participate. That's what diversity is supposed to be.
You've really hit on the main thing here. And one of the things about this kind of diversity that is often overlooked, or actually just utterly implicit in the sort of the way it's wielded, is the kind of essentialism that it involves, right? There is a kind of reductionism and essentialism to this kind of diversity that suggests particularly that so-and-so is X, right? Mm-hmm. And that as X, this person must think Y, right? Mm-hmm. So there is an assumption about politics, there's an assumption about behavior, there's assumption about cultural affiliation, there's an assumption about cultural values, cultural interests, and so on and so forth. It's reductionistic. It itself is stereotypical or stereotyping, and it is the worst sort of essentialism that suggests that particularly, let's say, a black person essentially believes this or essentially thinks that or essentially may be characterized as such and therefore necessarily will be offended by X, Y, or Z, rather than the fact that in fact, as Ralph Ellison fought so furiously to suggest in the 50s, as one of the main, I think, best writers in the African Renaissance, or I'm sorry, the American Renaissance in America, of African-American.
I agree.
That, in fact, the biggest problem that he faced as a human being was this assertion that there was some way, that there was some necessary essence of blackness that he had to reflect and that he had to exude in order to be accepted by such critics such as Irving Howe, who said he wasn't being the right kind of black author. Uh-huh. The problem, he said, was that this, in effect, was worse than Jim Crow. It put him in a cultural vacuum. It put him in what he called the world, in an essay called The World and the Jug. It put him in a jug with the cork on, through which he could see other cultures, but from which he could not borrow or even within which he could no longer participate. He was told that to be black, you had to be so and such a way. And he made clear, interestingly enough, and whether you like it or not, he said, look, my main models happen to be white people. That's not because they're white. It's because it's what I like. Okay. I like Marx. I like Eliot. I like this. I like that. I mean, you know, these are the people that have actually most informed my work. Sorry. And to deny me that is to deny me my humanity, which is far more fundamental than anything else.
And that's a great point. Kind of does tie in with the Invisible Man theme of being vulnerable to the gaze of the other, and in that case,
right,
just being kind of objectified and dismissed
exactly
as a subject. And of course,
exactly,
that's what Bakhtin also talks about in his work on Dostoevsky's Underground Man, which is a long monologue by a kind of a faceless bureaucrat in
the 19th
century.
Believe me, I know it. I love it.
Yeah, isn't that great? And so the Underground Man keeps anticipating what the reader is going to think of him and keeps trying to say,
yeah,
no, I'm not what you think I am. And he keeps changing in mid-sentence to, you know, I'm a spiteful man. I'm a whatever it was. I forget the opening line. But basically, this is an attempt by an individual to avoid being cast in stone by the gaze of somebody
right
else, pegging them into some stereotypical identity. And, you know, that's
exactly
real diversity is when you can, when you're free from these kinds of objectifying gazes of all of these powerful others. But unfortunately,
right,
this diversity movement in the university is doing the exact opposite. It's essentially destroying us all as free, independent subjects capable of free, independent thought, especially on these really important hot button issues.
As a matter of fact, it's beautiful that you got the way you've put this, it's the way you've connected this back to the gaze and panopticism and so forth. The nice thing about the interesting way that this is emblematized in the novel Invisible Man is that finally the character who remains nameless basically just hides, you know, what his point is to say, look, you will no longer define me. He basically obscures himself with sunglasses, effectively suggests that I'm going to put this veil in front of me, if you will, that you such that your gaze can no longer penetrate, define, or otherwise construct my identity for me. And that's how he ends it, which is just brilliant. Just brilliant.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book. Well, you know, one of the most obnoxious ways that we're being imprisoned in these objectifying gazes of the other is the way that these witch hunters apply these really nasty pejorative labels to you. For instance, you know, the most common ones that I've noticed are conspiracy theorist, anti-Semite, and Holocaust
right
denier. And as soon as I questioned 9/11, even though I was pointing the finger at Bush and Cheney, suddenly on my Wikipedia page appeared this Holocaust denier thing claiming that I somehow supported the work of three supposed Holocaust deniers, two of whom I hadn't even heard of, and the other one, David Irving, I hadn't bothered to read and didn't know anything about. So this was just made up out of nowhere, yet it wouldn't come down from my Wikipedia page. It was it was sourced to some, and not some blog, just some nobody's blog, that just some guy just made it up. And it wouldn't come down. And that got me curious. Wow, why, you know, okay, I question 9/11, I point the finger at Bush and Cheney, and suddenly I'm being called a Holocaust denier and it won't come down from my Wikipedia page. What's going on here? So I start looking into this Holocaust issue, and what I discover is that all sorts of folks are being locked up for their heretical opinions, and so I don't agree with that. So now I speak out and say, this is ridiculous. You didn't lock these people up, and now, boy, now they've decided I really am a Holocaust denier, because if you oppose witch hunts, you must be a witch. And so this kind of objectifying and labeling people with these labels that are designed to bring out negative emotions and to make people unemployable and socially, you know, hateful, this is becoming, it's really out of control. And, you know, frankly, Michael, it seems to me that the vast majority of this kind of academic witch hunting is coming out of the Zionist community. Stephen Salata, Norman Finkelstein. Go on.
I can't conjecture about that, and I won't comment on it. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, you know, for example, I mean, just on along these lines, a brilliant riposte to this is, of course, Finkelstein's very brilliant discussion in which he talks about the search for truth in academia and the problem of claiming that some people cannot be allowed to speak at all, okay, because their views are effectively opposed by the majority, and in particular, the liberal majority. And what he says is, in this brilliant video, the link for which I'm actually scrolling right now, is that, in fact, to say that that person can't speak is to suggest that you yourself or the community that you belong to is omniscient and that you are God, because the other person's explorations are not worthy of consideration at all. This means, in effect, that inquiry is gone. And just to give you an example of the way this has worked real recently, I just looked at this video, and I mean to cut you off here, but I don't want to suggest or imply anything about who's doing this or who's behind it. I don't know. I actually don't know. I'll be real frank. I'm agnostic with reference to those questions. But I will say this. There is what I will call liberal totalitarianism, and I put liberal in quotes, which is making certain, which is absolutely policing people and punishing people for anything that can be construed as either biased, hateful, oppositional in any way, making anyone uncomfortable about anything. For example, this was in Canada, and this was, this was filmed by another student. A woman approached this gentleman in a college. They're both college students in the bookstore. The guy, whatever you think of the politics of Trump or whatever, is wearing a Trump hat that says "Make America Great Again." This woman insists over and over that the man must remove this hat because this hat is hate speech and is not allowed. And the guy's like, "What are you talking about?" She said, "What Make America Great means is to ban immigrants, is to be homophobic, is to this, that, and the other thing." And the guy says, "There's nothing in the hat that says that, A. B, that's an interpretation of what Trump says. C, my own wife is actually an immigrant, okay?" And so forth and so on. So, I mean, this, and she says, "I'm going to report you," effectively to one of these biased reporting lines.
Oh, my
for
goodness.
For wearing a hat that says, "Make America Great Again." Similarly, a student was punished for writing in chalk, not in paint or anything like that, the word Trump on some steps in an elite institution, and for that, caught on tape, was punished severely. So this is what's going on.
That's interesting. And it's, I don't think that's a particularly effective way to try to oppose Trump, if that's what you want to do.
No,
all that does is you know, make it look like, you know, there must be something really cool about Trump to be able, you know. And likewise, it's the same thing with so many of these issues, like with the Holocaust issue. Right. I mean, the single biggest argument that these revisionists have is that, well, why would they be throwing us in prison if they could refute us?
Here's the thing, and if this is a this is a good segue, if you don't mind. My suggestion here is this actually ties into a follow up essay, which I'm going to put on which legitgov.org CLG News is going to publish as well. And that is my argument that this kind of liberal totalitarianism, and again, liberalism scare quotes, is in effect the very soil within which the alt-right is actually growing. It is,
yes.
It is dialectically producing the other that it hates,
absolutely.
Supposedly. So they're making, they're actually giving very good arguments to the other side. Very good arguments.
Absolutely.
Because what they're doing their totalitarianism is, of course, itself a massive problem, right?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely on that. You know, it's very strange. I remember that this sort of populist right, as I recall, when it was kind of really getting going with Rush Limbaugh's show coming out and these, you know, then his imitators, there was that big reaction to so-called political correctness. And I think I still sense that. I know people in that world. And that's what is driving it, I think. But I would also argue that it's not clear that the people who really are identifying with the oppressed are in agreement with this liberal totalitarian perspective. For instance, I had Cynthia McKinney on my show last night. I think she's the real voice of the underdog of our time. The, you know, the voice of
truth. I'm always sensitive to what she says. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and so her, she was advocating using this election to send a message by voting, let's see, ABC, which would be anybody but Clinton, or ABD, anybody but a Democrat. And her point is that it's these liberal totalitarians who've now made the Democratic Party the war party, that the neocon war party is now, you know, much more associated with the Democratic Party than with the Republican Party. And this offers an opportunity to sort of, you know, mess with the system by trying to, you know, rather than being sheep penned into voting for Hillary, instead sending a message by voting for third parties, especially, and even, you know, those who vote for Trump are probably helping mess with this extremely destructive system that's heading towards World War III. It's a very interesting argument. Of course, it goes cuts right across the, you know, it's exactly diametrically opposed to the liberal orthodox line. Yeah. But I think Cynthia may be right, and I do think that her perspective here is far more worthy of consideration than most of what I'm hearing from those representatives of the liberal orthodoxy who don't seem to care that, you know, Hillary Clinton was largely responsible for the destruction of Libya, that she wants to accelerate the destruction of Syria, that she wants to risk World War III with Russia, that the people, the neocons, most of the smarter neocons are actually behind her rather than Trump.
They're backing her.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, we're living in a really interesting period as all of this is.
I feel like I'm trapped in a cartoon in a comic book, actually. The political choices to me are like I'm actually trapped in a comic book, and I have nothing but villains here and there. The whole thing is like a mass charade. I can't make sense of it. It's just nuts. But I'd be very interesting to see if you ever have her on again. I'm sure you will, Cynthia McKinney, what she thinks about these issues that we're discussing with reference to these micro techniques here that I'd call the micro physics of power that I'm referring to with reference to these university. You know, I think the university is an important site, not because it's the powerhouse of intellectual production. Far from it at this stage. Rather, it is the place where the social order is largely reproduced. Therefore, what goes on there is significant from that standpoint. You know, people say, "Oh, well, you're in the ivory tower." You know, what? There's nothing. There's no politics there. Nothing politically important happens there. I get this a lot from some of my Marxist friends, and I say, "Listen, this is where a lot, especially in the United States, since basically the trades and everything else are effectively eviscerated, this is where the social order is being reproduced. So how can it not be an important site?"
Well, of course it's important. And you know, I had a very interesting encounter on the train back from New York, where I was participating in the 9/11 justice meeting of minds between the scientists and engineers and architects and the lawyers who were working on legal avenues to pursue the 9/11 case. Anyway, on the way back, I just happened to sit next to a guy who's very, very well informed on the thought of Leo Strauss. He has a PhD from a political science program here in the U.S. that, like so many of them, are dominated by Straussians. And so he showed me a piece he'd written on Strauss that was about as good as anything I've ever seen. It occurs to me that this Straussian takeover of poli-sci in the U.S. and the infiltration of so many other departments, especially history, these departments that are very much the ones where people go through pre-law and the ones that condition our way of seeing the political world, it's all been taken over by these Straussians. And the Straussian technique is to say, okay, you know, if you go to grad school with us, maybe we'll let you in on the secret, which is that, you know, we're this amoral Nietzschean elite that knows, you know, that there's no good in the world. And so our job is to cast the shadows on the cave wall to entrance the masses, feed them big lies and myths. And so that attitude, I think, has, you know, that the Straussians have reached, you know, such a level of influence that it allowed for, well, 9/11 is the supreme example. You know, if it didn't exist, the Straussians would have had to invent it. Well, they did invent it, actually.
It has come to my thinking very recently, in fact, last couple of days, the real significance of what the notion of what the postmodern means, in the sense that we really are living under postmodernism. And it really does tie back to Nietzsche and others, in this sense that, as Nietzsche put it, the truth is that which the powerful can make plausible and enforce. Okay? That is exactly what Nietzsche said. And Foucault, in effect, followed up with that, suggesting that truth was that which was in effect, the product of institutions and powers that could solidify it. Or as Bruno Latour put it, the truth is that which is too expensive to overthrow. Okay, so you certainly should understand the absolute relevance of that comment in connection with your pursuits.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, that's why they had to chase Jimmy Walter out of the country. Jimmy Walter spent millions of dollars on full-page ads saying 9/11 was an inside job in the Washington Post and New York Times. And then he got threats and his house was vandalized. And basically, he got the message that he had to leave the United States and retire from any form of 9/11 activity. And that's because, this is the truth is something that, you know, it would be expensive to challenge it. And if you have the kind of money that you can challenge it, then, you know, they'll deal with you.
I've said this before. And I'll say it again, and you may not like what I have to say in this respect, okay? But I'm going to put it out there anyway. We can disagree, but we can still be good friends, right? I don't believe that under contemporary circumstances of capitalism as such and the control of information, dissemination of information, media power, and so forth and so on, that under contemporary conditions, we can possibly know or have accepted, especially these kinds of matters, because I'm not subscribing to the postmodern notion that the truth, you know, that that's really the truth. Okay, what I'm saying is that, in fact, as you put it with these Straussians, the power elite are the postmodernists. Despite what they say in the media and how they, you know, how the so-called right wing lampoons postmodernism and such, the power elite have embraced, and they are the producers of this idea.
Yes.
They are the actual postmodernists as such.
Yes.
And I wrote an essay called "Capitalism." Postmodernism. Let me just look it up. I can't even remember what I've written.
Wow, you're such an accomplished scholar, Michael, that you can't even remember all of those pieces you've published.
It's called Postmodernism, the Academic Left, and the Crisis of Capitalism. And it suggests, in effect, this kind of complicity of academia with the postmodern. But I probably should follow up with this, because it's not really simply an infestation of the academy. Postmodernism is the very world we're living in right now. And that is, in the Foucauldian and the Nietzschean sense, that the truth is that which is deemed to be true by the powerful, by the Ubermensches, right? That's what it is. And I'm not saying that's the ultimate truth, as I think, in fact, as I say in this essay, the fact that the elite economists, the elite think tanks, none of these people predicted the crisis of 2008, right? If they really knew the truth, then why weren't they on top of it, as a matter of fact? Why weren't they able to see this coming? How come the actual material manifestations of the 2008 economic crisis nevertheless occurred if the truth were something that institutions produced exclusively? As a matter of fact, it escapes them at times, right? And they are not able to control everything. In effect, it gets out from underneath their particular constructs and power basis, and that's where you and I come in.
Yeah, well, I know that I and some of my friends actually predicted the 2008 crash based on the housing bubble was way out of control.
Yeah.
And now I would say there may, you know, I'm guessing there may be another adjustment in that direction, maybe not quite as big as 2008. Some say it's going to be worse. And the way you figure this out, my father was a finance professor, and he looked at stock prices over time, and there's this price-to-earnings ratio, and you know, he kind of said there's a limit to how far the price of stock can go above the dividends. And likewise,
yes,
there's a limit to how high the housing prices can go compared to people's incomes paying for housing.
Right.
And then there's always the other side that's juicing up the bubble, pumping up that bubble, that's saying, oh, no, we're living in a whole new world. And now housing prices can go up infinitely beyond people's incomes. And, you know, stock prices can go infinitely beyond the dividends that are being paid on the stocks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So, this is actually very, very, very consonant with postmodern notions that is the signs and the signifiers rather than the signified, which are actually the real thing, okay, as in postmodernism, as Jacques Derrida put it, there's nothing but text, as he put it. There's no outside of the text, okay? So he's suggesting that the signifiers, the texts, the stock prices, the manipulation of prices and all of that are really the reality that the underlying so-called material realities of commodities and such, that's not real.
Indeed.
The text itself is.
And that's another symptom of this postmodern worldview that we're talking about. And of course, I would argue from the historical perspective, this postmodern period that we're in is in fact the product of civilizational decadence. And I would argue that just as, you know, termite mounds in Africa rise and reach a certain level and then they kind of start falling apart, and that's just, there's a cycle there. Everyone from, you know, Ibn Khaldun to Spengler have noticed that civilizations are like that too, and obviously ours is really in the downswing. You know, obviously, truth is not an easy thing to define. There are many, many approaches to it, but to completely shelve it and set it aside, there's no such thing as reality, no such thing as truth. And, you know, I would go so far as into metaphysics, no such thing as God or some kind of metaphysical foundation, then that's a symptom of decadence. And that's where we are.
The only problem with I think that we, you know, I would concur to a certain extent. We live in a decrepit state of capitalism. I think it's in interminable, shall we say, stagnation that will not and cannot be reversed as such. There are no more liberal, neo-Keynesian, Keynesian, or any other kind of gadgetry they can throw at this to fix it. Now, as for civilization itself, the only problem I have with what you're saying is that it represents a kind of declinist model. And the only thing I have a problem with in terms of declinist models is the apparent or possible. I'm not saying you're guilty of this by any stretch. As the possible nostalgia that it represents about the past that may never have existed, that is, what are the good old days of that we're referring to that have been lost? So, you know, I don't know about whether civilization itself is declined. I think there's possibly going to be an, you know, there are certainly indications, given our ecological conditions and crises, that in fact, there's the prospect of an entire civilizational collapse is definitely not to be written off as utterly insane. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think there's a system of ideas and call it metaphysics, if you will, I think that is at the root of this. That is the material, you know, I would turn Marx on his head, you know, and go back to something a little more like Hegel, but say that this material world around us is the product of ideas or of a kind of Platonic reality. And when human beings are sort of on the upswing, you know, going, making, linking up with higher levels of this kind of platonic reality, the result is more order. And that order then infuses the world around them, and then the material civilization starts to rise. So for me, the good old days may not be very impressive from a space-time, you know, this is what it looks like on the planet. Here's how they're interacting with their, you know, ecosystem and building houses and things like that. Instead, that's where they're interacting with these other dimensions of reality in a very profound way. And then that's going to give rise to all sorts of phenomena in the material world. And then as that is lost, as that connection with, call it God if you want a simple word, is lost, then the civilization starts to fall apart. And I think ours has been falling apart for quite some time.
Well, we're on to matters of ontology, epistemology, and metaphysics and stuff. Where that's it's fascinating. I mean, you know, what I meant by the nostalgia for the good old days. You know, just for example, I mean, you know, what I would say in class, for example, if I were in a classroom at this point, I would say, yeah, I mean, there's certain something to be said. Certainly, great thinking took place. Plato, for example, was brilliant. But I mean, you know, what about the 99%? We're slaves, things like that. But I understand what you're getting at. I mean, I am not toting historical materialist dogma by any stretch. I believe in a kind of, I think it's a false dichotomy between idealism and materialism. I do think that actually ideas and matter are effectively practices and behaviors and, you know, and ideas and effectively are, they're connected in some very intimate, inextricable way. I don't think you can actually separate them out such that the forms have nothing to do with our interactions with anything and so forth and so on. So, yeah, I understand what you're getting at. But in the idea of truth, I think, or objectivity as at least a, shall we say, purposeful and necessary myth is very much in jeopardy. I do think the idea of truth or objectivity as such, as a necessary, even if it's a myth, it's necessary in order to undergird any kinds of investigations, or we're doomed. Then it's just the whatever the powerful say is true, that's it.
Okay, well, that's a good place to leave it for today. I'd love to have you back and maybe get deeper into this kind of metaphysical discussion. And
I would
agree with a lot of what you just said. The inextricably interlinked, I'll buy into that, and we'll have to take it from there next time.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Okay, thank you. Michael Rechtenwald, it's always great to talk to you. Keep up the great work.
And for you, I applaud your courage, your tenacity, your perseverance, and so forth, okay? I just want you to know that's all. I regard you with great esteem.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.